He relies heavily on text messages to coordinate with his staff, and he soon relearned how hard it is to type on the little plastic buttons of an old-fashioned cell phone. But Adam is a digital minimalist, which means maximizing convenience is prioritized much lower than using technology to support his values. As a father, teaching his kids an important lesson about embracing life beyond the screen was far more important than faster typing. Not all digital minimalists end up completely rejecting common tools. For many, the core question of, is this the best way to use technology to support this value, leads them to carefully optimize services that most people fiddle with mindlessly. Michal, for example, decided her obsession with online media was causing more harm than good. In response, she restricted her digital information intake to a pair of email newsletter subscriptions and a handful of blogs that she checks less than once a week. She told me that these carefully selected feeds still satisfy her craving for stimulating ideas and information without dominating her time and toying with her mood. Another digital minimalist named Charles told me a similar story. He had been a Twitter addict before adopting this philosophy. He has since quit that service and instead receives his news through a curated collection of online magazines that he checks once a day in the afternoon. He told me that he's better informed than he was during his Twitter days, while also now thankfully freed of the addictive checking and refreshing that Twitter encourages in its users. Digital minimalists are also adept at stripping away superfluous features of new technologies to allow them to access functions that matter while avoiding unnecessary distraction. Karina, for example, is on the executive council of a student organization that uses a Facebook group to coordinate its activities. To prevent this service from exploiting her attention every time she logs on for council business, she reduced her set of friends down to only the 14 other people on the executive council, and then unfollowed them. This preserves her ability to coordinate on the Facebook group, while at the same time keeping her news feed empty. Emma found a different approach to a similar end when she discovered that she could bookmark the Facebook notifications screen, allowing her to jump straight to the page that shows posts from a graduate student group she follows, bypassing the service's most distracting features. Blair did something similar, bookmarking the Facebook events page so she could check on upcoming community events while bypassing all the junk that Facebook is made up of. Blair told me that keeping up with local events through this bookmarked page takes about 5 minutes, once or twice a week. Karina and Emma report similarly minuscule times spent using the service. The average Facebook user, by contrast, uses the company's products a little over 50 minutes per day. These optimizations might seem small, but they yield a major difference in these digital minimalists' daily lives. A particularly heartwarming example of digital minimalism unlocking new value is the story of Dave, a creative director and father of three. After embracing minimalism, Dave reduced his persistent social media use down to only a single service, Instagram, which he felt offered significant benefits to his deep interest in art. In true minimalist fashion, however, Dave didn't settle for simply deciding to use Instagram. He instead thought hard about how best to integrate this tool into his life. In the end, he settled on posting one picture every week of whatever personal art project he happens to be working on. "It's a great way for me to have a visual archive of my projects," he explained. He also follows only a small number of accounts, all of which belong to artists whose work inspires him, making the experience of checking his feed both fast and meaningful. The reason I like Dave's story, however, is what was enabled by his decision to significantly cut back on how much he uses these services. As Dave explained to me, his own father wrote him a handwritten note every week during his freshman year of college. Still touched by this gesture, Dave began a habit of drawing a new picture every night to place in his oldest daughter's lunchbox. His two youngest children watched this ritual with interest. When they became old enough for lunchboxes, they were excited to start receiving their daily drawings as well. Fast forward a couple of years, and I'm spending a decent chunk of time every night doing three drawings, Dave told me with obvious pride. This wouldn't have been possible if I didn't protect how I spend my time. The Principles of Digital Minimalism. So far in this chapter, I've argued that the best way to fight the tyranny of the digital in your life is to embrace a philosophy of technology use based in your deeply held values. I then proposed digital minimalism as one such philosophy and provided examples of it in action. Before I can ask you to experiment with digital minimalism in your own life, however, I must first provide you with a more thorough explanation for why it works. My argument for this philosophy's effectiveness rests on the following three core principles. Principle number one, clutter is costly. Digital minimalists recognize that cluttering their time and attention with too many devices, apps, and services creates an overall negative cost that can swamp the small benefits that each individual item provides in isolation. Principle number two, optimization is important. Digital minimalists believe that deciding a particular technology supports something they value is only the first step. To truly extract its full potential benefit, it's necessary to think carefully about how they'll use the technology. Principle number three, intentionality is satisfying. Digital minimalists derive significant satisfaction from their general commitment to being more intentional about how they engage with new technologies. This source of satisfaction is independent of the specific decisions they make, and is one of the biggest reasons that minimalism tends to be immensely meaningful to its practitioners. The validity of digital minimalism is self-evident once you accept these three principles. With this in mind, the remainder of this chapter is dedicated to proving them true. An argument for principle number one, Thoreau's New Economics. Near the end of March in 1845, Henry David Thoreau borrowed an axe and walked into the woods near Walden Pond. He felled young white pine trees, which he hewed into studs and rafters and floorboards. Using more borrowed tools, he notched mortise and tenon joints and assembled these pieces into the frame of a modest cabin. Thoreau was not hurried in these efforts. Each day he brought with him a lunch of bread and butter wrapped in newspaper, and after eating his meal, he would read the wrapping. He found time during this leisurely construction process to take detailed notes on the nature that surrounded him. He observed the properties of the late-season ice on the pond and the fragrance of the pine pitch. One morning, while soaking a hickory wedge in the cold pond water, he saw a striped snake slide into the pond and lay still on the bottom. He watched it for over a quarter of an hour. In July, Thoreau moved into the cabin, where he then lived for the next 2 years. In the book Walden, he wrote about this experience, famously describing his motivation as follows. "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived." Over the ensuing decades, as Thoreau's ideas diffused through pop culture and people became less likely to confront his actual text, his experiment at Walden Pond has taken on a poetic tinge. Indeed, the passion-seeking boarding school students in 1989's Dead Poets Society opened their secret poetry reading meetings by reciting the deliberate living quote from Walden. Thoreau, we imagine, was seeking to be transformed by the subjective experience of living deliberately, planning to walk out of the woods changed by transcendence. There's truth to this interpretation, but it misses a whole other side to Thoreau's experiment. He had also been working out a new theory of economics that attempted to push back against the worst dehumanizing effects of industrialization. To help validate his theory, he needed more data, and his time spent by the pond was designed in large part to become a source of this needed information. It's important for our purposes to understand this more pragmatic side to Walden, as Thoreau's often overlooked economic theory provides a powerful justification for our first principle of minimalism, that more can be less. The first and longest chapter of Walden is titled Economy. It contains many of Thoreau's signature poetic flourishes about nature and the human condition. It also, however, contains a surprising number of bland expense tables, recording costs down to a fraction of a cent, such as the following. House, $28.12.5. Farm, 1 year, $14.72.5. Food, 8 months, $8.74. Clothing, etc., 8 months, $8.40.75. Oil, etc., 8 months, $2. In all, $61.99.75. Thoreau's purpose in these tables is to capture precisely, not poetically or philosophically, how much it cost to support his life at Walden Pond, a lifestyle that, as he argues at length in this first chapter, satisfies all the basic human needs, food, shelter, warmth, and so on. Thoreau then contrasts these costs with the hourly wages he could earn with his labor to arrive at the final value he cared most about. How much of his time must be sacrificed to support this minimalist lifestyle? After plugging in the numbers gathered during his experiment, he determined that hiring out his labor only 1 day per week would be sufficient. This magician's trick of shifting the units of measure from money to time is the core novelty of what the philosopher Frederic Gros calls Thoreau's New Economics, a theory that builds on the following axiom, which Thoreau establishes early in Walden. The cost of a thing is the amount of what I will call life which is required to be exchanged for it, immediately or in the long run. This New Economics offers a radical rethinking of the consumerist culture that began to emerge in Thoreau's time. Standard economic theory focuses on monetary outcomes. If working 1 acre of land as a farmer earns you $1 a year in profit, and working 60 acres earns you $60, then you should, if it's at all possible, work the 60 acres. It produces strictly more money. Thoreau's New Economics considers such math woefully incomplete, as it leaves out the cost in life required to achieve that extra $59 in monetary profit. As he notes in Walden, working a large farm, as many of his Concord neighbors did, required large, stressful mortgages, the need to maintain numerous pieces of equipment, and endless, demanding labor. He describes these farmer neighbors as crushed and smothered under their load, and famously lumps them into the mass of men leading lives of quiet desperation. Thoreau then asks what benefits these worn-down farmers receive from the extra profit they eke out. As he proved in his Walden experiment, this extra work is not enabling the farmers to escape savage conditions. Thoreau was able to satisfy all of his basic needs quite comfortably with the equivalent of 1 day of work per week. What these farmers are actually gaining from all the life they sacrifice is slightly nicer stuff. Venetian blinds, a better quality copper pot, perhaps a fancy wagon for traveling back and forth to town more efficiently. When analyzed through Thoreau's New Economics, this exchange can come across as ill-conceived. Who could justify trading a lifetime of stress and back-breaking labor for better blinds? Is a nicer-looking window treatment really worth so much of your life? Similarly, why would you add hours of extra labor in the fields to obtain a wagon? It's true that it takes more time to walk to town than to ride in a wagon, Thoreau notes, but these walks still likely require less time than the extra work hours needed to afford the wagon. It's exactly these types of calculations that lead Thoreau to observe sardonically, "I see young men, my townsmen, whose misfortune it is to have inherited farms, house, barns, cattle, and farming tools, for these are more easily acquired than got rid of." Thoreau's New Economics was developed in an industrial age, but his basic insights apply just as well to our current digital context. The first principle of digital minimalism presented earlier in this chapter states that clutter is costly. Thoreau's New Economics helps explain why. When people consider specific tools or behaviors in their digital lives, they tend to focus only on the value each produces. Maintaining an active presence on Twitter, for example, might occasionally open up an interesting new connection, or expose you to an idea you hadn't heard before. Standard economic thinking says that such profits are good, and the more you receive, the better. It therefore makes sense to clutter your digital life with as many of these small sources of value as you can find, much as it made sense for the Concord farmer to cultivate as many acres of land as he could afford to mortgage. Thoreau's New Economics, however, demands that you balance this profit against the costs measured in terms of your life. How much of your time and attention, he would ask, must be sacrificed to earn the small profit of occasional connections and new ideas that is earned by cultivating a significant presence on Twitter? Assume, for example, that your Twitter habit effectively consumes 10 hours per week. Thoreau would note that this cost is almost certainly way too high for the limited benefits it returns. If you value new connections and exposure to interesting ideas, he might argue, why not adopt a habit of attending an interesting talk or event every month, and forcing yourself to chat with at least 3 people while there? This would produce similar types of value, but consume only a few hours of your life per month, leaving you with an extra 37 hours to dedicate to other meaningful pursuits. These costs, of course, also tend to compound. When you combine an active Twitter presence with a dozen other attention-demanding online behaviors, the cost in life becomes extreme. Like Thoreau's farmers, you end up crushed and smothered under the demands on your time and attention, and in the end, all you receive in return for sacrificing so much of your life is a few nicer trinkets, the digital equivalent of the farmer's Venetian blinds or fancier pot, many of which, as shown in the Twitter example earlier, could probably be approximated at a much lower cost, or eliminated without any major negative impact. This is why clutter is dangerous. It's easy to be seduced by the small amounts of profit offered by the latest app or service, but then forget its cost in terms of the most important resource we possess, the minutes of our life. This is also what makes Thoreau's New Economics so relevant to our current moment. As Frederic Gros argues, the striking thing with Thoreau is not the actual content of the argument. After all, sages in earliest antiquity had already proclaimed their contempt for possessions. What impresses is the form of the argument. For Thoreau's obsession with calculation runs deep. He says, "Keep calculating, keep weighing. What exactly do I gain or lose?" Thoreau's obsession with calculation helps us move past the vague subjective sense that there are trade-offs inherent in digital clutter, and forces us instead to confront it more precisely. He asks us to treat the minutes of our life as a concrete and valuable substance, arguably the most valuable substance we possess, and to always reckon with how much of this life we trade for the various activities we allow to claim our time. When we confront our habits through this perspective, we will reach the same conclusion now that Thoreau did in his era. More often than not, the cumulative cost of the non-crucial things we clutter our lives with can far outweigh the small benefits each individual piece of clutter promises. An argument for principle number 2, the return curve. The law of diminishing returns is familiar to anyone who studies economics. It applies to the improvement of production processes and says at a high level that investing more resources into a process cannot indefinitely improve its output. Eventually, you'll approach a natural limit and start experiencing less and less extra benefit from continued investment. A classic example from economics textbooks concerns workers on a hypothetical automobile assembly line. At first, as you increase the number of workers, you generate large increases in the rate at which finished cars come off the line. If you continue to assign more workers to the line, however, these improvements will get smaller. This might happen for many reasons. Perhaps, for example, you begin to run out of space to add the new workers, or other limiting factors, like the maximum speed of the conveyor belt, come into play. If you plot this law for a given process and resource, with value produced on the y-axis and amount of resource invested on the x-axis, you'll encounter a familiar curve. At first, as additional increases in resources cause rapid improvements in output, the curve rises quickly. But But over time, as the returns diminish, the curve flattens out. The exact parameters of this return curve vary between different processes and resources, but its general shape is shared by many scenarios, a reality that has made this law a fundamental component of modern economic theory. The reason I'm introducing this idea from economics in this chapter on digital minimalism is the following. If you're willing to accept some flexibility in your definition of production process, the law of diminishing returns can apply to the various ways in which we use new technologies to produce value in our personal lives. Once we view these personal technology processes through the perspective of diminishing returns, we'll gain the precise vocabulary we need to understand the validity of the second principle of minimalism, which states that optimizing how we use technology is just as important as how we choose what technologies to use in the first place. When considering personal technology processes, let's focus in particular on the energy invested in trying to improve the value these processes return in your life. For example, through better selection of tools or the adoption of smarter strategies for using the tools. If you increase the amount of energy you invest into this optimization, you'll increase the amount of value the process returns. At first, these increases will be large. As the law of diminishing returns tells us, however, eventually these increases will diminish as you approach a natural limit. To make this more concrete, let's work through a brief hypothetical example. Assume that you find it important to remain informed about current events. New technologies can certainly help you support this goal. Perhaps, at first, the process you deploy is just keeping an eye on the links that pop up in your social media feeds. This process produces some value, as it keeps you more informed than if you weren't using the internet at all for this purpose, but it leaves a lot of room for improvement. With this in mind, assume you invest some energy to identify a more carefully curated set of online news sites to follow, and to find an app like Instapaper that allows you to clip articles from these sites and read them all together in a nice interface that culls distracting ads. This improved personal technology process for keeping informed is now producing even more value in your personal life. Perhaps, as the final step in this optimization, you discover through trial and error that you're best able to absorb complex articles when you clip them throughout the week and then sit down to read through them all on Saturday morning on a tablet over coffee at a local cafe. At this point, your optimization efforts have massively increased the value you receive from this personal technology process for staying informed. You can now stay up to date in a pleasing manner that has a limited impact on your time and attention during the week. As the law of diminishing returns tells us, however, you're probably nearing the natural limit, after which improving this process further will become increasingly difficult. Put more technically, you've reached the later part of the return curve. The reason the second principle of minimalism is so important is that most people invest very little energy into these types of optimizations. To use the appropriate economic terminology, most people's personal technology processes currently exist on the early part of the return curve, the location where additional attempts to optimize will yield massive improvements. It's this reality that leads digital minimalists to embrace the second principle and focus not just on what technologies they adopt, but also on how they use them. The example I just gave was hypothetical, but you will find similar instances of optimization producing big returns when you study the stories of real-world digital minimalists. Gabriella, for example, signed up for Netflix as a better and cheaper source of entertainment than cable. She became prone, however, to binge-watching, which hurt her professional productivity and left her feeling unfulfilled. After some further experimentation, Gabriella adopted an optimization to this process. She's not allowed to watch Netflix alone. Gabriella is not alone in this optimization. I was surprised to discover multiple digital minimalists, usually young people, who found a good balance by restricting streaming entertainment to social situations. This restriction still allows her to enjoy the value Netflix offers, but to do so in a more controlled manner that limits its potential for abuse and strengthens something else she values, her social life. Now streaming shows is a social activity instead of an isolating activity, she told me. Another optimization that was common among the digital minimalists I studied was to remove social media apps from their phones. Because they can still access these sites through their computer browsers, they don't lose any of the high-value benefits that keep them signed up for these services. By removing the apps from their phones, however, they eliminated their ability to browse their accounts as a knee-jerk response to boredom. The result is that these minimalists dramatically reduced the amount of time they spent engaging with these services each week, while barely diminishing the value they provide to their lives. A much better personal technology process than thoughtlessly tapping and swiping these apps throughout the day as the whim strikes. There are two major reasons why so few people have bothered to adopt the bias toward optimization exhibited by Gabriella or the minimalists who streamlined their social media experience. The first is that most of these technologies are still relatively new. Because of this reality, their role in your life can still seem novel and fun, obscuring more serious questions about the specific value they're providing. This freshness, of course, is starting to fade as the smartphone and social media era advances beyond its heady early years, which will lead people to become increasingly impatient with the shortcomings of their unpolished processes. As the author Max Brooks quipped in a 2017 TV appearance, "We need to reevaluate our current relationship with online information, sort of the way we reevaluated free love in the 80s. The second reason so few think about optimizing their technology use is more cynical. The large attention economy conglomerates that introduced many of these new technologies don't want us thinking about optimization. These corporations make more money the more time you spend engaged with their products. They want you, therefore, to think of their offerings as a sort of fun ecosystem where you mess around and interesting things happen. This mindset of general use makes it easier for them to exploit your psychological vulnerabilities. By contrast, if you think of these services as offering a collection of features that you can carefully put to use to serve specific values, then almost certainly you'll spend much less time using them. This is why social media companies are purposely vague in describing their products. The Facebook mission statement, for example, describes their goal as giving people the power to build community and bring the world closer together. This goal is generically positive, but how exactly you use Facebook to accomplish it is left underspecified. They hint that you just need to plug into their ecosystem and start sharing and connecting, and eventually, good things will happen. Once you break free from this mindset, however, and begin seeing new technologies simply as tools that you can deploy selectively, you're able to fully embrace the second principle of minimalism and start furiously optimizing, enabling you to reap the advantages of vaulting up the return curve. Finding useful new technologies is just the first step to improving your life. The real benefits come once you start experimenting with how best to use them. An argument for principle number 3, the lessons of the Amish hacker. The Amish complicate any serious discussion of modern technology's impact on our culture. The popular understanding of this group is that they're frozen in time, reluctant to adopt any tools introduced after the mid-18th century period when they first began settling in America. From this perspective, these communities are mainly interesting as a living museum of an older age, a quaint curiosity. But then you start talking to scholars and writers who study the Amish seriously, and you begin to hear confusing statements that muddy these waters. John Hostetler, for example, who literally wrote the book on their society, claims the following: Amish communities are not relics of a bygone era. Rather, they are demonstrations of a different form of modernity. The technologist Kevin Kelly, who spent a significant amount of time among the Lancaster County Amish, goes even further, writing, "Amish lives are anything but anti-technological. In fact, on my several visits with them, I have found them to be ingenious hackers and tinkers, the ultimate makers and do-it-yourselvers. They are often, surprisingly, pro-technology. As Kelly elaborates in his 2010 book, What Technology Wants, the simple notion of the Amish as Luddites vanishes as soon as you approach a standard Amish farm, where, cruising down the road, you may see an Amish kid in a straw hat and suspenders zipping by on rollerblades. Some Amish communities use tractors, but only with metal wheels so they cannot drive on roads like cars. Some allow a gas-powered wheat thresher, but require horses to pull the smoking, noisy contraption. Personal phones, cellular or household, are almost always prohibited, but many communities maintain a community phone booth. Almost no Amish communities allow automobile ownership, but it's typical for Amish to travel in cars driven by others. Kelly reports that the use of electricity is common, but it's usually forbidden to connect to the larger municipal power grid. Disposable diapers are popular, as are chemical fertilizers. In one memorable passage, Kelly talks about visiting a family that uses a $400,000 computer-controlled precision milling machine to produce pneumatic parts needed by the community. The machine is run by the family's bonnet-wearing 10-year-old daughter. It's housed behind their horse stable. Kelly, of course, is not the only person to notice the Amish's complicated relationship with modern technologies. Donald Craybill, a professor at Elizabethtown College who co-authored a book on the Amish, emphasizes the changes that have occurred as more members of these communities embrace entrepreneurship over farming. He talks about an Amish wood shop with 19 employees who use drills, saws, and nail guns. But instead of receiving power from the electric grid, they use solar panels and diesel generators. Another Amish entrepreneur has a website for his business, but it's maintained by an outside firm. Craybill has a term for the nuanced and sometimes contrived ways that these startups use technology: Amish hacking. These observations dismiss the popular belief that the Amish reject all new technologies. So what's really going on here? The Amish, it turns out, do something that's both shockingly radical and simple in our age of impulsive and complicated consumerism. They start with the things they value most, then work backward to ask whether a given new technology performs more harm than good with respect to these values. As Craybill elaborates, they confront the following questions. Is this going to be helpful, or is it going to be detrimental? Is it going to bolster our life together as a community, or is it going to somehow tear it down? When a new technology rolls around, there's typically an alpha geek, to use Kelly's term, in any given Amish community that will ask the parish bishop permission to try it out. Usually, the bishop will agree. The whole community will then observe this first adopter intently, trying to discern the ultimate impact of the technology on the things the community values most. If this impact is deemed more negative than helpful, the technology is prohibited. Otherwise, it's allowed, but usually with caveats on its use that optimize its positives and minimize its negatives. The reason most Amish are prohibited from owning cars, for example, but are allowed to drive in motor vehicles driven by other people, has to do with the impact of owning an automobile on the social fabric of the community. As Kelly explains, when cars first appeared at the turn of the last century, the Amish noticed that drivers would leave the community to go picnicking or sightseeing in other towns, instead of visiting family or the sick on Sundays, or patronizing local shops on Saturday. As a member of an Amish community explained to Craybill during his research, when people leave the Amish, the first thing they do is buy a car. So owning a car is banned in most parishes. This type of thinking also explains why an Amish farmer can own a solar panel or run power tools on a generator, but cannot connect to the power grid. The problem is not electricity, it's the fact that the grid connects them too strongly to the world outside of their local community, violating the Amish commitment to the biblical tenet to be in the world, but not of it. Once you encounter this more nuanced approach to technology, you can no longer dismiss the Amish lifestyle as a quaint curiosity. As John Hostetler explained, their philosophy is not a rejection of modernity, but a different form of it. Kevin Kelly goes a step further and claims that it's a form of modernity that we cannot ignore given our current struggles. In any discussion about the merits of avoiding the addictive grasp of technology, he writes, the Amish stand out as offering an honorable alternative. It's important to understand what exactly makes this alternative honorable, as it's in these advantages that we'll uncover a strong argument for the third principle of minimalism, which claims that approaching decisions with intention can be more important than the impact of the actual decisions themselves. At the core of the Amish philosophy regarding technology is the following trade-off. The Amish prioritize the benefits generated by acting intentionally about technology over the benefits lost from the technologies they decide not to use. Their gamble is that intention trumps convenience. And this is a bet that seems to be paying off. The Amish have remained a relatively stable presence in America for over 200 years of rapid modernity and cultural upheavals. Unlike some religious sects that attempt to entrap members through threats and denial of connection to the outside world, the Amish still practice Rumspringa. During this ritual period, which begins at the age of 16, Amish youth are allowed to leave home and experience the outside world beyond the restrictions of their community. It is then their decision, after having seen what they will be giving up, whether or not they accept baptism into the Amish church. By one sociologist's calculations, the percentage of Amish youth that decide to stay after Rumspringa is in the range of 80-90%. We should be careful, however, not to push the Amish example too far as a case study for meaningful living. The restrictions that guide each community, called the Ordnung, are typically decided and enforced by a group of four men, a bishop, two ministers, and a deacon, who serve for life. There's a communion ceremony performed twice a year in which complaints about the Ordnung can be aired and consensus pursued, but many in these communities, including notably women, can remain largely disenfranchised. From this perspective, the Amish underscore the principle that acting intentionally with respect to technology can be a standalone source of value, but their example leaves open the question of whether this value persists even when we eliminate the more authoritarian impulses of these communities. Fortunately, we have good reasons to believe it does. A useful thought experiment along these lines is to consider the closely related Mennonite church. Like the Amish, Mennonites embrace the biblical principle to be in the world but not of it, which leads to a similar embrace of simplicity and a suspicion of cultural trends that threaten core values of maintaining strong communities and virtuous living. Unlike the Amish, however, the Mennonites include more liberal members who integrate with the broader society, taking on personal responsibility for making decisions in a way that's consistent with their church's principles. This creates an opportunity to see Amish-style values toward technology applied in the absence of an authoritarian Ordnung. Curious to encounter this philosophy in action, I set up a conversation with a liberal Mennonite named Laura, a schoolteacher who lives with her husband and daughter in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Laura attends a local Mennonite church and lives in a neighborhood with at least a dozen other Mennonite families, which keeps her connected to this community's values. But decisions about her lifestyle are hers alone. This latter point hasn't stopped her from acting with intention regarding her technology choices. This reality is best emphasized by what is arguably her most radical decision. She has never owned a smartphone and has no intention of buying one. "I don't think I'd be a good smartphone user," she explained to me. "I don't trust myself to just let it be and not think about it. When I leave the house, I don't think about all of these distractions. I'm free from it." Most people, of course, would dismiss the possibility of ditching their phone by listing all the different things it makes slightly easier, from looking up a restaurant review in a new city to using GPS directions. The loss of these small dollops of value doesn't concern Laura. "Writing down directions before leaving home is not a big deal for me," she says. What Laura does care about is the way her intentional decision supports things she finds massively valuable, such as her ability to connect with people she cares about and enjoy life in the moment. In our conversation, she emphasized the importance of being present with her daughter, even when bored, and the value she gets out of spending time with friends free from distraction. Laura also connects efforts to be a conscientious consumer with issues relating to social justice, which also play a big role in the Mennonite church. As with the Amish, who find contentment without modern conveniences, an important source of Laura's satisfaction with her smartphone-free life comes from the choice itself. "My decision to not use a smartphone gives me a sense of autonomy," she told me. "I'm controlling the role technology is allowed to play in my life." After a moment of hesitation, she adds, "It makes me feel a little smug at times." What Laura describes modestly as smugness is almost certainly something more fundamental to human flourishing, the sense of meaning that comes from acting with intention. Pulling together these pieces, we arrive at a strong justification for the third principle of minimalism. Part of what makes this philosophy so effective is that the very act of being selective about your tools will bring you satisfaction, typically much more than what is lost from the tools you decide to avoid. I tackled this principle last because its lesson is arguably the most important. As demonstrated by the Old Order Amish farmer happily riding a horse-drawn buggy, or the urban Mennonite content with her old-fashioned cell phone, it's the commitment to minimalism itself that yields the bulk of their satisfaction. The sugar high of convenience is fleeting, and the sting of missing out dulls rapidly. But the meaningful glow that comes from taking charge of what claims your time and attention is something that persists. A new look at old advice. The central idea of minimalism, that less can be more, is not novel. As mentioned in the introduction, this concept dates back to antiquity and has been repeatedly espoused since. The fact, therefore, that this old idea might apply to the new technologies that define so much about our current age shouldn't be surprising. That being said, the past couple of decades are also defined by a resurgent narrative of techno-maximalism that contends more is better when it comes to technology, more connections, more information, more options. This philosophy cleverly dovetails with the general objective of the liberal humanism project to offer individuals more freedom, making it seem vaguely illiberal to avoid a popular social media platform or decline to follow the latest online chatter. This connection, of course, is specious. Outsourcing your autonomy to an attention economy conglomerate, as you do when you mindlessly sign up for whatever new hot service emerges from the Silicon Valley venture capitalist class, is the opposite of freedom and will likely degrade your individuality. But given the current strength of the maximalism argument, I felt it necessary to provide the full-throated defense of minimalism detailed in this chapter. Even old ideas require new investigation to underscore their continued relevance. When it comes to new technologies, less almost certainly is more. Hopefully, the preceding pages made it clear why this is true. 3. The digital declutter. On rapidly becoming minimalist. Assuming I've convinced you that digital minimalism is worthwhile, the next step is to discuss how best to adopt this lifestyle. In my experience, gradually changing your habits one at a time doesn't work well. The engineered attraction of the attention economy, combined with the friction of convenience, will diminish your inertia until you backslide toward where you started. I recommend instead a rapid transformation, something that occurs in a short period of time and is executed with enough conviction that the results are likely to stick. I call the particular rapid process I have in mind the digital declutter. It works as follows. The digital declutter process. 1. Put aside a 30-day period during which you will take a break from optional technologies in your life. 2. During this 30-day break, explore and rediscover activities and behaviors that you find satisfying and meaningful. 3. At the end of the break, reintroduce optional technologies into your life, starting from a blank slate. For each technology you reintroduce, determine what value it serves in your life and how specifically you will use it so as to maximize this value. Much like decluttering your house, This lifestyle experiment provides a reset for your digital life by clearing away distracting tools and compulsive habits that may have accumulated haphazardly over time and replacing them with a much more intentional set of behaviors, optimized in proper minimalist fashion to support your values instead of subverting them. As noted earlier, the second part of this book will provide ideas and strategies for shaping your digital minimalist lifestyle into something sustainable over the long term. My suggestion, however, is to start with this declutter, and then once your transformation has begun, look to the chapters that follow to optimize your setup. As is often true in life, getting started is the most important step. With this in mind, we'll continue by looking closer at the details of executing the digital declutter. Fortunately, as I'll explain next, when it comes to examining how best to succeed with this process, we don't have to start from scratch. Many others have trod this path before. In early December 2017, I sent an email to my mailing list that summarized the main ideas of this process. "I'm looking for volunteers," I wrote, "who are willing to attempt a digital declutter during the month of January and provide me updates along the way." I expected 40 to 50 brave readers to volunteer. My guess was wrong. Over 1,600 signed up. Our efforts even made national news. In February, I began to gather more detailed reports from participants. I wanted to find out what rules they put in place regarding their technology use during the declutter and how they fared during the 30-day period. I was particularly interested to hear about the decisions they made when reintroducing these technologies back into their lives. After receiving and reviewing hundreds of these in-depth dissections, two conclusions became clear. First, the digital declutter works. People were surprised to learn the degree to which their digital lives had become cluttered with reflexive behaviors and compulsive tics. The simple action of sweeping away this detritus and starting from scratch and crafting their digital life felt like lifting a psychological weight they didn't realize had been dragging them down. They came out of the declutter with a streamlined digital lifestyle that felt, in some ineffable sense, right. The second clear conclusion I reached is that the declutter process is tricky. A non-trivial number of people ended up aborting this process before the full 30 days were done. Interestingly, most of these early exits had little to do with insufficient willpower. This was an audience who was self-selected based on their drive to improve. More common were subtle mistakes in implementation. A typical culprit, for example, was technology restriction rules that were either too vague or too strict. Another mistake was not planning what to replace these technologies with during the declutter period, leading to anxiety and boredom. Those who treated this experiment purely as a detox, where the goal was to simply take a break from their digital life before returning to business as usual, also struggled. A temporary detox is a much weaker resolution than trying to permanently change your life, and therefore much easier for your mind to subvert when the going gets tough. Given the reality of this second conclusion, I will dedicate the remainder of this chapter to providing clarifying explanations and suggestions for the three steps of the declutter process summarized previously. For each of these steps, I'll provide detailed examples from participants in my mass digital declutter experiment to help you avoid common pitfalls and tweak your experience to maximize your probability of success. Step number one, define your technology rules. During the 30 days of your digital declutter, you're supposed to take a break from optional technologies in your life. The first step of the declutter process, therefore, is to define which technologies fall into this optional category. When I say technology in this context, I mean the general class of things we've been calling new technologies throughout this book, which include apps, websites, and related digital tools that are delivered through a computer screen or a mobile phone and are meant to either entertain, inform, or connect you. Text messaging, Instagram, and Reddit are examples of the types of technologies you need to evaluate when preparing for your digital declutter. Your microwave, radio, or electric toothbrush are not. An interesting special case brought to my attention by many participants during the mass declutter experiment is video games. These can't be neatly classified under the new technology label, as they've been around for decades before the digital network and mobile computing revolutions of the past 20 years. But many people, especially young men, feel an addictive pull to these games that's similar to what they experience from other new technologies. As a 29-year-old business owner named Joseph told me, he feels restless without video games to occupy my downtime. He ended up classifying these games, alongside his compulsive blog consumption, as factors in his digital life that were wearing him down. If, like Joseph, you think these games are a non-trivial part of your life, feel free to put them on the list of technologies you're evaluating when figuring out your declutter rules. Another borderline case is television, which in an age of streaming is a vague term that can cover many different visual entertainments. Prior to the mass declutter experiment, I was somewhat ambivalent as to whether streaming Netflix and its equivalents was something to consider as a potentially optional technology. The feedback I received from participants, however, was near unequivocal. You should. As a management consultant named Kate told me, "I have so many ideas I'd like to implement, but every time I sat down to work on them, somehow Netflix appeared on my screen." These technologies, participants like Kate insisted, should be included when defining your personal declutter rules. Once you've identified the class of technologies that are relevant, you must then decide which of them are sufficiently optional that you can take a break from them for the full 30 days of the declutter process. My general heuristic is the following. Consider the technology optional unless its temporary removal would harm or significantly disrupt the daily operation of your professional or personal life. This standard exempts most professional technologies from being deemed optional. If you stop checking your work email, for example, this would harm your career, so you can't use me as an excuse to shut down your inbox for a month. Similarly, if your job requires you to occasionally monitor Facebook Messenger to help recruit students, as was the case for a music professor named Brian who participated in my experiment, then, of course, this activity is not optional either. On the personal side, these exemptions usually apply to technologies that play a key logistical role. If your daughter uses text messaging to tell you when she's ready to be picked up from soccer practice, then it's okay to still use text messages for this purpose. Similar exemptions also apply when a technology's removal might cause serious harm to relationships. For example, using FaceTime to talk with a spouse deployed overseas with the military. Don't, however, confuse convenient with critical. It's inconvenient to lose access to a Facebook group that announces campus events, but in a 30-day period, this lack of information won't cause any critical damage to your social life, and it might expose you to interesting alternative uses for your time. Similarly, several participants in the mass declutter experiment claimed they needed to keep using instant message tools like WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger because it was the easiest way to keep up with friends overseas. This might be true, but in many cases, these relationships can withstand 1 month of less frequent contact. More importantly, the inconvenience might prove useful. Losing lightweight contact with your international friends might help clarify which of these friendships were real in the first place, and strengthen your relationships with those who remain. This is exactly what happened with Anya, a participant in my experiment who is from Belarus, but is currently studying at an American university. As she told the New York Times in an article about my experiment, taking a break from online socializing with her international friends helped her feel more invested in the time I spend with people. Because we interacted less frequently, we had this idea that we wanted to make the most of the experience. A college sophomore named Kushbu put it even simpler when he told me, "In a nutshell, I only lost touch with people I didn't need, or in some cases, didn't even want, to be constantly in touch with." My final suggestion is to use operating procedures when confronting a technology that's largely optional, with the exception of a few critical use cases. These procedures specify exactly how and when you use a particular technology, allowing you to maintain some critical uses without having to default to unrestricted access. I saw many examples of these operating procedures deployed by the participants in my mass declutter experiment. A freelance writer named Mary, for example, wanted to take a break from constantly tending to text messages on her phone. "I'm from a very large and very texty family," she told me. The problem was that when her husband traveled, which he did frequently, he sometimes sent Mary messages that needed fast responses. Her solution was to reconfigure her phone to send a special alert for texts from her husband, but suppress notifications for all other messages. Similarly, an environmental consultant named Mike needed to keep up with personal emails, but wanted to avoid compulsive checking. So he made the rule that he could only sign in to his account from his desktop PC and not his phone. A computer scientist named Caleb decided he could still listen to podcasts, but only on his 2-hour-long daily commute. "The thought of only listening to whatever the radio sent my way was too daunting for me," he explained. Brooke, a self-described writer, educator, and full-time mother, decided she wanted to swear off access to the internet altogether, but, to make this sustainable, added 2 exceptions for when she could still launch a web browser: email and buying household items on Amazon. I also noticed a lot of creativity surrounding how people throttled back streaming media in contexts where they didn't want to eliminate it altogether. A college freshman named Ramel abstained from streaming media except when doing so with other people, explaining, "I did not want to isolate myself in social situations where entertainment was playing." A professor named Nathaniel, on the other hand, didn't mind high-quality entertainment in his life, but worried about binge-watching, so he adopted a clever restriction: no more than 2 episodes of any series per week. I would estimate around 30% of the rules described by participants were caveated with operating procedures, while the remaining 70% were blanket bans on using a particular technology. Generally, too many operating procedures might make the declutter experiment unwieldy, but most people required at least a few of these more nuanced constraints. To summarize the main points about this step, the digital declutter focuses primarily on new technologies, which describes apps, sites, and tools delivered through a computer or mobile phone screen. You should probably also include video games and streaming video in this category. Take a 30-day break from any of these technologies that you deem optional, meaning that you can step away from them without creating harm or major problems in either your professional or personal life. In some cases, you'll abstain from using the optional technology altogether, while in other cases, you might specify a set of operating procedures that dictate exactly when and how you use the technology during the process. In the end, you're left with a list of banned technologies along with relevant operating procedures. Write this down and put it somewhere where you'll see it every day. Clarity in what you're allowed and not allowed to do during the declutter will prove key to its success. Step number 2. Take a 30-day break. Now that you have defined your technology rules, the next step of the digital declutter is to follow these rules for 30 days. Obviously, your declutter does not have to span exactly 30 days. It's often convenient, for example, to connect the experiment to a calendar month, which means you might use 31 days or perhaps 28 days, depending on the month in which you run the process. You'll likely find life without optional technologies challenging at first. Your mind has developed certain expectations about distractions and entertainment, and these expectations will be disrupted when you remove optional technologies from your daily experience. This disruption can feel unpleasant. Many of the participants in my mass declutter experiment, however, reported that these feelings of discomfort faded after a week or two. Brooke described this experience as follows: "The first few days were surprisingly hard. My addictive habits were revealed in striking clarity. Moments of waiting in line, moments between activities, moments of boredom, moments I ached to check in on my favorite people, moments I wanted an escape, Moments I just wanted to look something up. Moments I just needed some diversion. I'd reach for my phone and then remember that everything was gone. But then things got better. As time